You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, when's the last time you checked your credit scores? Because your scores may change more often than you think, and you should know what they are now and not from a year ago. You know what they say, information is power, and Credit Karma is here to help out. The best thing? Credit Karma is always free and there's no catch, no credit card needed. Go to creditkarma.com or download the Credit Karma app now. Again, that's creditkarma.com or download the app. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. 2016 was the election that all the pundits and pollsters got wrong, but one unlikely political prognosticator predicted a Trump victory as early as August 2015. Scott Adams, the creator of the popular Dilbert cartoons, became a regular fixture on the political talk shows, claiming that Donald Trump had as much as a 98% chance of winning the election because Trump is what he calls a master persuader. Adams ought to know, in addition to penning his popular Dilbert cartoons every week and several best-selling books, Scott Adams says he's a trained hypnotist, skilled in the same art of persuasion employed by President Trump. And in his new book, titled Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter, Scott breaks down exactly how Donald Trump pulled off an unconventional victory and how anyone can employ the exact same persuasion tools to get what they want in any situation or setting. Today, Scott will reveal why Donald Trump makes what he claims are intentional errors and misstatements, why facts and ideology no longer matter, and how Trump uses what he calls linguistic kill shots to flatten his opponents. He'll also weigh in on why Trump's persuasion skills haven't been very effective on Congress, and whether or not Trump supporters should be insulted that they're being manipulated by their president. Plus, how to hypnotize anyone, how Scott's endorsement of Donald Trump has affected his Dilbert readership, and he makes an early prediction for 2020. Coming up with the creator of Dilbert, Scott Adams, in just a moment. Scott Adams is the creator of Dilbert, one of the most popular comic strips of all time. His many bestsellers include The Dilbert Principle, Dogbert's Top Secret Management Handbook, and How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. Now he's getting political with his latest book called Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Scott, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been drawing Dilbert cartoons for, I guess, over two decades now. How many papers would you say run Dilbert these days?
Well, I'm sad to say it's closer to three decades now.
And oh, is it really?
Yeah. Wow. I hate to admit that. We're in about 2,000 newspapers worldwide. Wow. And lots of different languages.
Wow. And you said in 2015 that you wanted to go into political analysis sort of out of nowhere and become a pundit. My question is why? I mean, everybody loves Dilbert. You're set for life. Why would you go into the ugly world of politics and, you know, have to deal with half the country hating you?
Well, I didn't think I was. It was a little bit accidental because what I write about is persuasion specifically. Mm-hmm. I'm also a trained hypnotist, and I've been studying the ways of persuasion in all its forms for many years. And when I saw Donald Trump come on the scene, I recognized in him a similar set of persuasion tools that I thought the public might not recognize. So I thought, well, this will be interesting. I'll just blog about this. And those blog posts just took off. They became viral. And then it was just too tempting to write about it because people liked it, and I thought it was useful to see a different dimension.
Now, I didn't know that. You're a trained hypnotist. How did you get into that, and why?
Well, I was influenced by my mother, who was hypnotized by my family doctor when she gave birth to my younger sister. And my mother reports, and I can't verify the truth of any of this, but this was her story, that she was under hypnosis when she gave birth and felt no pain, yet was awake and aware of the entire process. Now, this is not something you could do with most people, but about 1 in 5 people can be hypnotized to experience what they call the phenomenon, which is, you know, the ability to not feel pain or to see something that's not there, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the thing that I've always heard was no one really hypnotizes you to do anything that you don't want to do. This idea that you can force people to, I don't know, chirp like a bird or run around like a monkey or something. They have to, at some level, be a willing participant. It's something that they want to do, even if it's subconsciously, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit like taking a driving lesson and, you know, the instructor's in the other seat. And if the instructor said, now, drive off the bridge. You probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Right? So that's similar to hypnosis. You are aware of what the hypnotist is telling you, and you can process it the same way you would not under hypnosis.
Well, in August 2015, I believe it was, you gave Trump a 98% chance of winning the election long before the media caught wind that anything was happening with the electorate. What did you see that made you so certain about Trump?
Well, obviously, you can't win the election without lots of variables working for you. So he had, you know, a lot of things had to happen for it to go the way it did. But I thought that persuasion and his persuasion skills would be the most predictive of all those variables. And what I saw was someone who had, you know, a full arsenal that was completely invisible to the other side. Because if you don't study this stuff, you can't tell that he's using it. It just looks random and crazy and provocative, and you just don't know what's going on.
You attribute Trump's victory to his prowess as this master persuader, and you talk about how successful people have what you call a talent stack, a set of skills that work particularly well together, congruous with each other. What things are in Trump's talent stack?
So a lot of people don't know that his pastor, when he was a kid, his church was led by Norman Vincent Peale, who was famous also as the author of The Power of Positive Thinking. It was a hugely influential book in its time, and it told people how to essentially think their way into a better situation. And you see that level of optimism in a lot of what the president does. So, for example, when he talks about the economy, instead of doing what a normal politician would do and say, hey, we got 3% GDP, that's pretty good, he'll say, we got 3%, but it could have been 4, except for the hurricane. I think it's going to be 4. So you can see him actually bringing our minds to the new place. And in that case, since the economy is based on psychology, people invest today based on how they think it's going to be next year, they hear that kind of talk, and then they invest, and he actually creates the economy by talking about where it's going to go, literally. Huh. And so that's just one element, right? But he's also, his father was a successful business person, so we assume he learned some of those negotiating skills. He wrote a book on negotiating, so we know he knows that level of persuasion. We observe that he's good at sales, marketing, branding, and even design. You know, everything from the hats to his buildings are all parts of design. And every bit of that is a persuasion element. And then you look at his sense of humor, which is also part of good persuasion, his ability to speak in public, his complete immunity from shame, shall we say, allows him to attract attention to himself in a way that civilians just can't do. They just wouldn't be able to go there. So he has not just a bunch of things that he has presumably learned or picked up over the years, but his personality gives him that extra level that makes him a master persuader. instead of what I would call myself, more of a commercial grade persuader, someone who uses it in his work. I use it to write. But I couldn't take the types of risks he takes. And when I say risks, I mean with his own reputation.
Yeah. Now, before we get into these particular areas of persuasion, I'm curious, do you have any particular political affiliation?
I don't vote. And part of that is my understanding of persuasion, because as soon as you vote, you take a side, and then you can no longer see the other side. You just become blind to it. And that's a pretty well-known phenomenon. But beyond that, I define myself as left of Bernie. You know, I'm ultra-liberal, but I prefer plans that have a chance of working, which is where I have some distinction between Bernie's plans and my preferences. So I don't line up with the Republican policies, except by a few coincidences. So I feel I can be a little bit more objective that way.
When you started supporting Trump, how did Dilbert fans react?
Well, as soon as you wade into this other area, you get first the bunch of people who say, stick with your day job. You know, don't change fields. You're just embarrassing yourself. And I've gotten that every time I've changed fields. So I'm kind of used to that one. But then people assume that even though you're writing about his talent as a persuader, and by the way, when Hillary Clinton did good things in that field, I pointed them out, you know, with equal enthusiasm. But since he was so much better at this narrow area of persuasion, it was hard not to gush about it.
You mentioned Hillary there. Throughout the course of the campaign, you endorsed Hillary and then Trump, I think, or Trump, then Hillary, then Gary Johnson, and back to Trump. Explain the thought process there. Was that just entirely who was most persuasive at the moment there or what?
No, some of that was tactical and for my safety. So I started
for
out
your safety.
Yeah, I started out endorsing no one because that felt, you know, the most honest. But it became clear that I was in physical danger because people were associating me with Trump. And they were calling him Hitler, and they really meant it this time. You know, it's not like other times. They really meant it.
Yeah, it seems like it.
And they were calling me Joseph Goebbels, his PR person. Now, here's the thing. If you're saying somebody's Hitler in sort of a, you know, exaggerated way, that doesn't mean much. But if people are actually starting to think that this is a real live Hitler who could take us in that direction, you have moral authority to kill that person. To actually kill them. Mm. And that would have included me because they perceived that I was somehow a positive influence for that direction. And so I thought, well, I'll fix that. I'll use persuasion. I'll use my talent for persuasion to fix it. And so I told the world, you know, through social media that I was going to endorse Hillary Clinton for my safety. And I always appended for my safety.
Yeah.
Now, the Trump supporters just laughed because they were sort of in on the joke.
Okay. And was it a joke?
Well, it was.
There was a little bit of a
it was meant to be
sarcasm.
Funny, but also functional.
Yeah.
And Clinton supporters immediately backed off because they said, well, we don't care why you're on the team. we'll go bother someone else. So that worked well for a number of months. And where I changed was the bullying got really bad. But also when Clinton said she wanted to increase the death tax or the estate tax, depending which party you're in, you can call it either one, I realized that for the rest of my life, I would be taxed as 75 cents for every dollar, about half of it when I make it, and you know if you count state taxes as well. And then when I died, she'd take the half of what was left. And since I've already made all the money that I need— I literally work for the benefit of other people. I'm basically a public servant in that sense.
Yeah, especially in California.
And that was just too far. That was personal, and it was so over the line for me that I took a side. But then I had to – I quickly retreated when the Access Hollywood tape broke.
Yeah.
And for a while, Trump was so toxic, you didn't want to be in the same zip code with him.
Yeah.
And so I backed off, and I endorsed Gary Johnson under the theory that Gary Johnson was a safer candidate because he only touches himself. So that that felt a lot safer. But that, of course, wasn't a serious endorsement. And then toward the end, the bullying got so bad I mean, the threats, the bullying, there's just something that snapped in my head. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening, I know you're rolling your eyes. You're saying, no, the Trump supporters were the bullies. But screw you. I was personally being bullied.
You were. Okay.
And I was looking to solve my problem.
Yeah.
I completely acknowledge other people had other problems. I'm not minimizing them at all. I'm telling you my story. I was being bullied online in ways you can't even believe. It was, you know, everything from my height to my baldness to, you know, my sexual prowess, you name it. They went after everything, and they went hard. And finally, just something flipped in my brain, and mm-hmm. I just said, screw these people. This is the party of hate. Mm-hmm. In fact, I call them that now, the Democratic Party. I've labeled them the party of hate, or POH, because all I see these days is literally hate. And so I did a full-throated endorsement of Trump, primarily because the bullies just flipped my switch in my head and I couldn't flip it back.
So their tactics turned on him. One thing that I found interesting about this is you say that political affiliation had little to do with Trump's victory. Trump would have won the election even if he'd run as a Democrat, you say. Are we to take that to mean that political ideology doesn't really matter anymore?
Well, facts don't matter to our decisions. We just think they do.
Yeah.
Now, they certainly matter to the outcomes. If you walk in front of a truck and the truck hits you, that's a fact, and you wish that hadn't happened. But what a hypnotist learns is that the world is upside down from the way normal people see it. Normal people say, well, we're a rational species, and 90% of the time we use facts and logic. Okay, 10% of the time we get a little crazy, but 90% of the time we're pretty rational. The hypnotist reverses that. And in fact, you can't even do hypnosis unless you understand this first, that we are fundamentally an irrational species who doesn't know it. And we rationalize after the fact. Now, I learned this decades ago when there wasn't much in the way of scientific backing. Today, there are lots of popular books that support that quite clearly. I'm reading Nudge right now. Mm-hmm. If you've read the books by Robert Cialdini, Influence and Persuasion, there's just mm-hmm. plenty of science now that says we don't use reason to make decisions, except for the minor stuff that has no emotional impact. So that filter I see everywhere. I see us not using facts. For example, the fact that no matter who is running for office, the vote is going to be about 50-50 for president anyway.
Right.
We're all looking at the same facts. And it's not like some of us are jerks and that's what explains it all. Well, of course, some people are jerks. But that's not what explains it. People are just going to vote their team mm-hmm. and they're going to rationalize it later as all the reasons they had.
Now, you say that you recognized certain hypnotist techniques that Trump was using. What types of techniques was he using to hypnotize the audience?
Well, hypnosis is sort of a one corner of persuasion, which is mm-hmm. a bigger field. So in Trump's case, he wasn't hypnotizing so much
okay.
as persuading.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the techniques that are most obvious is he would often talk in a visual way.
Okay.
And visual persuasion is one of the most powerful persuasions. So, for example, instead of saying, I'd like to have better border control, we'll use a variety of techniques depending on the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fall asleep listening to that and you don't remember it tomorrow. Instead, he says, no, it's going to be a wall, a big, beautiful wall.
Yeah.
He allows you to imagine
the image.
The wall in your head.
Uh-huh.
But then here's the best part, and this is also a technique. He says, I'm going to make Mexico pay for it. Now, forget about how impractical that is. He's making you think past the sale. This is classic persuasion technique.
Oh, interesting.
So while you're thinking about whether or not Mexico would pay for the sale, you have somehow uncritically accepted the notion that, yeah, there could be a wall there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's moving you in that direction with visual persuasion as well as thinking past the sale. And he does that consistently. And then you also see his technique with his nicknames. They're not random at all. They're deeply engineered.
You call those linguistic kill shots, right?
Right. So low energy Jeb.
Mm-hmm.
First, he picks a type of label that you don't see in politics that immediately gets your attention because the mind is drawn to anything and a place. Then he's framed him as low energy. He's taken Jeb's strength, which is he's this cool, collected, experienced executive. Exactly the kind of guy you want if there's a crisis. But the moment he contrasted it to his own high energy campaign, you could never see Jeb any other way but low energy. And the other thing he builds into his nicknames is they're magnets for confirmation bias. In other words, every time you see him, you're again reminded because you think of Trump at the big rallies. Then you see Jeb just sort of talking.
A little bit of a reflection of the perception that people already have about that person.
Yeah, yeah. You start with what they already might be thinking, right? So Lion Ted, Crooked Hillary.
Yeah.
You knew that there would be stories coming out because it was a campaign that would suggest that they actually had done crooked things and had actually lied. Now, independent of whether any of those things is true, you know that people are going to be thinking, ah, there's another story about Crooked Hillary. So, and also, none of his nicknames can be reversed into the positive. There's no such thing.
Yeah.
Low energy, there's no way that's good. Crooked, Lion, there's no way this is good. But Dangerous and Cheeto and Jesus, they all have a positive.
Yeah, no one can use that to contrast themselves with Trump. Huh?
Right.
Interesting.
Now, the other thing I touched on is that he operates in what I call a narrow band of wrongness, meaning that his tweets, his speeches, his nicknames, his opponents keep looking at him and saying, darn it, these are not presidential. These are not presidential at all. Now, that's true. But once you realize it's intentional, it's the way that he gets all the attention. And the first thing you need to do to persuade is get people's attention. And if that's half of the job, getting attention, no one has ever done it better. And even his opponents would agree on at least that half of it. And then if you know persuasion, you can see the other half is really, I don't think genius is too small of a word in this case, which is not to say he's done everything right and never made a mistake. I have plenty of my own criticisms of things he could have done better. But the nicknames will go down in history as brilliant.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Scott Adams when we come back in just a minute. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping for the holidays, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding to make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. I've used Grasshopper for our podcast's 800 number, and they make sure everything runs smoothly so I don't have to worry and can focus on the important things. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. You know, having dealt in politics myself, I noticed that typical politicians never use the term liar. They say disingenuous or their opponent is not being truthful. They always play it safe and stop just short of calling someone a liar because for whatever reason, it's unpresidential or it's not considered good form. I don't know. But the fact that he was willing to call someone crooked or a liar outright certainly separates him from the typical politician and their tentative and circumspect way of speaking.
But it's even better than that. He didn't call Lion Ted lying Ted. Mm-hmm. He called him Lion with an apostrophe and no G, which made you also pause and say, well, is that important? Is it important that the G's there? Why does that make a difference?
Okay.
And again, this is technique. He's making you stop, pause, talk about it, think about it. Can't get it out of your head.
And you were talking about sometimes he purposely may say something wrong or make mistakes or say something that most people would consider to be a misfire or a liability. But you say that it's all intentional because when he makes an error or misstatement, it causes his critics to talk about him in the media and so forth, and it ends up attracting more attention to whatever the message was. Yep. Is that sort of like saying there's no such thing as bad publicity?
So let me modify what you said just a little bit. I would never say that everything he's doing is intentional and that none of them are mistakes.
Okay.
Sometimes he just gets a fact wrong, right? And some people would say lots of times. But when you notice that he gets things wrong, they tend to be directionally accurate. So in other words, if he's trying to tell you something needs to be done about violence in Chicago, he might say, well, 1,000 people a day are getting killed there. He didn't actually say that. But and then you would say, that's not true. There can't be more than 10 people a day getting killed in Chicago. But you've already talked yourself into Chicago being the thing you want to focus on, talk about there's too much violence. So the difference between leadership and just manipulating or being a con man is intention. And if you look at the things he gets wrong, there are almost always – I can't think of an exception. There might be, but offhand I can't think of one. They're always directionally where he's trying to lead people that is at least compatible with Republican philosophy.
Yeah, and you talk about Trump's use of what you call strategic ambiguity. This is an interesting one because – he has this habit of not always speaking in full sentences, or he'll begin a thought and then he'll just kind of trail off or leave it dangling, which one could argue leaves it for the audience to fill in the rest with their own confirmation bias and whatnot. Would this be an example of his use of strategic ambiguity?
Well, my favorite example is if you're going to run as a Republican, you need to be religious. You know, it just helps to be a Christian because you're going to pull in more votes. But he didn't have much of a resume as being a hardcore Christian. So he made his case and said, yeah, I love the Bible. It's the best Bible. You know, it's the best book. And the people who wanted to believe that he was religious because they wanted to back him, they said, yeah, good enough. You know, you love the Bible. I love the Bible. We're the same person. Mm-hmm. But the people who didn't want too much religion intruding in government and wanted a little more separation, they looked at him and said, ah, that's just something he's saying to get elected. So he actually gave both sides something to embrace that they could talk themselves into.
And another tool that he uses is you say that he asks directly by ending and beginning statements with the words, believe me. Now, when I hear someone say, believe me, I think to myself, you know, he doth protest too much. If he's being truthful, why is he asking me to believe him? But you say asking someone to believe you is persuasive. How so?
Well, you have to sort of rank how powerful each of these techniques is. So this would be on the weak side.
This is not a kill shot.
Right. This is not a kill shot. But it does help to simply directly ask for what you want because people are sort of hard-coded to give you what you want. The best example of this is in I think it's in Cialdini's book, Influence. They talk about a study in which they see if they can get better cooperation by using the word because. And if you put because in the sentence, it doesn't matter if the thing after that is complete nonsense or not, that they could find statistically they got much better cooperation. So if I said to you, for example, hey, could I use your studio tomorrow because it's raining?
Yeah. You know, even if it's not.
It's just great. Yeah. And it doesn't matter
But it's a reason.
Why would the rain have anything to do with why I could use your studio? And they find that it's just the form of the sentence. People are just sort of hard-coded to respond to a because. Now, with a direct response, a direct request in which you don't have much resistance to, he makes a statement. Let's say it's not something that you have any strong disagreement with. And he just says, it's true. It's true. Yeah. He often says it twice. He'll say, I'm going to make this the best country. Right. It's true. It's true.
Yeah. 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 He does that. Well, let's talk about probably the most iconic thing of his whole campaign, the red trucker hats that say, make America great again. They were all over the place. What made that hat and that so persuasive?
Well, it helps to compare it to the alternatives. One of the slogans, I think there were 85 slogans that the Clinton campaign cycled through before they found one that wasn't good. And then they really never got a good one. But one of their worst was, I'm with her.
Oh, right.
Which literally lasted
a while.
Well, that suggests that the election was about her as opposed to the voters.
Yeah.
People are selfish by nature. All right. But it also suggested that it was about her gender. which is not only counter to her own brand, but offensive to half of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, why is the her part important?
Right. We're supposed to be a merit-based country.
She'd also made the most, the biggest, one of the biggest, maybe the biggest, persuasion mistake you can make, which is selling past the clothes. Right.
It's, so in
a store, if somebody talks you into buying something, you say, yeah, let's take this to the cash register. And then the salesperson is walking to the cash register and says, you know, you'll be really happy with this. It's one of the top two products in the world. And you say, wait a minute, what's the other one? Right. So he needed to shut up once he had made the sale. Uh-huh. Hillary had already sold the world that it was time
it was
for
inevitable.
A woman. Yeah, there was going to be a woman president.
Right.
I literally never heard one person say that that was a plus or a minus. The world was just ready. And then she kept selling. And she sold past the clothes. Now, compare that to make America great again. Every word in that phrase is power. Make, manufacture, do, action, make. It's a great word. It's a solid word. Even the letters in it, make. You know, it just sounds good. Great. What's wrong with great? Nothing.
Sure.
It's great. America. It's the best word you could possibly have in your slogan. And then again, gave people reason to argue about it, but it also caused them to focus on it. But it also has kind of a percussion to it. If you just listen to "I'm with her," it's almost like a whisper or a wind in the trees.
It's not crisp.
Now listen to the drum beat of "Make America Great Again." Make America Great Again. It's almost percussion.
Mm-hmm. And the choice of color, red. That's a powerful color.
Yeah, red's the boss of all colors. Yeah. I like to call it. It's the action. It's the importance. It's the look at me. It's everything.
Yeah.
Now it helped that that's a Republican color.
Right.
But trust me, if the Republican color had been baby blue, he would not have put it on a hat.
And certainly not pink, I'm sure.
The pink so-called pussy hats were just not a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Now, do you think Trump was aware that he was doing these things in the moment? Is it part of a pre-planned strategy or is it just innately how he operates?
I believe he actually got a trademark on Make America Great Again several years ago.
Right. That's true.
So everything about what I've seen suggests technique – minus, you know, a few offhand comments that maybe he probably wishes he could take back. But if you consider how much he talked in public, there were not many things that were off persuasion perfection.
Mm-hmm. And Wynn Bigley, you talk about those Trump voters who were particularly susceptible to persuasion, referring to them as moist robots and programmable entities. Shouldn't they be insulted by that?
Or? No, I'm sure I didn't refer to specifically his supporters. I talk about people as being moist robots and programmable.
Okay.
But in the context of a race, since, as I said before, people are going to line up with their team no matter what. Mm-hmm. It's going to be sort of a 50-50. What he had was 18 months or so to convince perhaps 2% of the public who was persuadable, the people who just didn't have a big emotional connection to either side for that race. When you have that much time and you have that much talent, moving 2% is as close as you can get to a guarantee unless there's some external shock that is unexpected.
Okay.
So that was the basis for me saying he had a 98% chance of winning all the way back in 2015. Because give me a year and a half and tell me I only have to move 2% of the public, I'm going to get that done. Even with my level of talent, I could get that done. For him, it just seemed easier.
The subtitle to Wynn Bigley is Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Some might say that's a pretty cynical view of things. Shouldn't facts matter?
Well, they certainly matter to the outcome.
Right? Okay.
So everybody cares about facts when it comes to the result. But we just don't use those facts for decisions. I like to use the OJ trial as a universal reference for those who were around to watch that. I don't think the facts had anything to do with the result of the trial. It probably had as much to do with Johnny Cochran cleverly saying, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, which is actually something we learned in hypnosis class. The things that rhyme register as more true than things that don't. Completely irrational, but it's true.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. After the election, a lot of people in the media wanted to sort of rain on Trump's parade and say, well, Trump didn't really win the election. Hillary lost it. Right. You know, people weren't voting for Trump. They were voting against Hillary. Do you think that it was a matter of Trump being persuasive or Hillary dissuading the voters?
Well, I would say that, first of all, Hillary won the contest that she wasn't in. So they were never in a popular vote contest. So while it probably feels good to the team that didn't get what they want to say, well, you know, on this level we won. If you were to look at the Electoral College, that was the one that mattered, and he dominated that. He used probably better analytics, so he knew where to go and when. So he had superior business decisions. I think Hillary probably didn't see it coming. I think there was a little bit of surprise. maybe she could have done some things differently. And I think he had a better read on the public, which is also part of perception or persuasion. I mean, you have to first understand who you're trying to persuade, and then you can persuade them. I think Clinton did not understand those people that she called the deplorables. I think that was just a blind spot she had.
There's a big difference between getting elected and governing. Do you think Trump's persuasion skills will carry over to being an effective president?
I think we can answer that question already.
Oh, yeah?
I give the prior administration at least 70%, 75% of the credit for the strong economy. I think Obama did a great job, even though people listening to this, half of them are swearing at me right now. But he did leave it on a solid footing from a very low point when he took office. I give him full credit for that. But there is clearly some kind of a kick that happened after the election. And that appears to be related to consumer confidence and business confidence that seems directly related to the administration. Now, of course, they're looking at things like, well, I think he's going to do something with taxes and that's good. But I think those are maybe rationalizations. There's simply an optimism that he brings to it that is infectious. If you're talking about the Supreme Court, then it's very successful because the Republicans got who they wanted. If you're talking about the battle of ISIS, we see once again that persuasion was probably important. Because instead of saying, well, we're going to be there for a while and then leave, as Obama did, which persuades them actually to stay and fight harder.
Yeah,
he said, we're going to be there forever and we're not going to surround you and then give you a pass out. We're going to annihilate. And now for the first time, we're seeing not only lots of progress, and that of course is persuasive as well, but we're seeing surrenders. And we're seeing great progress there. And I think that the way he persuaded the military to take their own decisions in the field, I think that gives them an entirely different feeling about the fight. So probably he was good for morale. He was probably terrible for morale at ISIS. So probably in that field it makes a difference.
So even ISIS is persuadable, huh?
Well, they got persuaded into ISIS.
Yeah, well, that's true. There you go. Okay.
So everybody's persuadable.
Yeah.
And then you look at foreign affairs. People were worried. Hey, this crazy guy, what are the other leaders going to think? Well, we've got Netanyahu loves him. Saudi Arabia is actually becoming more moderate. Mm-hmm. They seem to love him. You know, he goes to China and then he's treated as a rock star in China. It doesn't seem to be a problem. In fact, he might be one of the most popular presidents, at least for a number of countries, that we've ever seen.
But let me ask you this then. If Trump is such a great persuader, how come he can't convince more people in Congress and the Senate to pass his signature policies like building the wall or replacing Obamacare?
Well,
Why is he having such trouble with the people inside the Beltway?
Well, was there a deadline?
No, but it's coming up on a year.
Remember, it took him 18 months to move 2% of the public.
Right.
So persuasion is almost always a long game.
Okay.
If you take any one of those issues, let's take healthcare. Healthcare has so far been an abysmal failure, and part of that would certainly be on him as president, although Congress was taking the lead. What he did is he went into a situation and there were no bills that even had any chance of passing. He allowed the Republicans to fail hard a couple of times in public to soften him up. at the same time, he scared the pants off of the left by the things that the Republicans almost got passed. So he softened both ends, because the only thing that's ever going to get passed is something that's closer to the middle. Mm-hmm. And now he's actually said, well, maybe I'll talk to the Democrats. Mm-hmm. So now he's persuading both sides toward the middle. Mm-hmm. By staying out of the early fights, he can be the independent who comes in and says, okay, you know, I told you before, if you could put something on my desk, I almost don't care what it is. If it gets rid of Obamacare, I'll sign it. But you couldn't deliver. Mm-hmm. I would expect that by summer, you're going to see something that has a lot more of his fingerprint on it that will be the first time he's seriously persuading. Because he stood away from the fight on healthcare. So you can't say his persuasion didn't work. You can certainly say he didn't use it.
You predicted a Trump win once. What odds do you give him at re-election in 2020?
I'm not entirely sure he would run.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think if he has a great 4 years, and by Republican standards, he's off to a good start, while his critics would say, you have done nothing, even though you can list them, right? Mm-hmm. Economy, ISIS, courts, blah, blah. I think it'll probably come down to healthcare and North Korea. And we're seeing some movement in North Korea, because for the first time, the head of North Korea is probably waking up and saying to himself, I don't know if I'll be alive a month from now. Huh. I don't think they've ever thought that before.
Yeah.
And this is all part of the persuasion game. He has scared them while also being completely reasonable and dealing with China and all those things. Mm-hmm. So he's put real doubt in their minds for the first time. And I think that's going to make a difference. And he's friendlier with China than we've ever seen. Well, I guess ever. You might have the best relationship with China, maybe of all time. We'll see how this shakes out. So if he gets something going on those two things, he has an option of going out on top. And once you consider age, and I think that matters. Like I thought both candidates, Clinton and Trump, were too old, frankly. Yeah. I was not in favor of either one of them for that reason alone. But a second term would be pushing it.
Okay.
Just in terms of age.
Okay. Do you have odds in your mind on whether he would run?
I think if his first 4 years are great, there's a 70% chance he won't run.
Interesting. If he can go out on top, then he'll probably go golf and have fun and enjoy himself for the rest of his life.
Being an ex-president who made his family name and his company proud would be quite a good way to go out.
Now, if he hasn't accomplished that much in the first term, you think that might motivate him more to want to do a second term just to go out on a high note?
I think so. I think his natural competitive nature is if there's something in particular that he thought he could do and it's not done yet, I think he'd be like a pit bull. I don't think he could let go.
Well, let me persuade you to check out Scott Adams' book. It's called Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Scott, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks again to Scott Adams for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter, on Amazon, or download the audiobook on Audible. Visit Scott's website at blog.dilbert.com and follow him on Twitter at Scott Adams Says. Today's episode was sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using Credible.com's simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying on your student loans. You could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. And for a limited time, my listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. That's Credible.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.